Welcome everyone to the Longhorn Republic, your source for Texas Longhorn news, sports, and opinions with a bit of snark built. And you're a member of the 1012 Podcast Network. You can find all the great coverage of the Big 12 over at 1012network.com. If you like what we do, please leave us a rating or review on Apple Podcasts. It helps get the show out there. Share this with your friends where you found it, whether it was Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Stitcher, TuneIn, Spotify, anywhere where you find fine podcast content. You can find Kyle and myself. Connect with us on social media at Longhorn Pod on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, Longhorn Republic. Shoot us an email, longhornrepublicpod@gmail.com. I'd also like to remind you, this podcast is brought to you by our friends over at Charlie Hustle Clothing Company. They are a vintage-inspired clothing company based out of Kansas City that specializes in collegiate and hometown apparel. They want you to be the best dressed fan all year long, so be sure to check out their wide selection of officially licensed collegiate apparel today and show off your school spirit all year long. With more than 30 schools to choose from, they've got you covered with all your collegiate apparel needs, and you can get 15% off any non-sale item by using the code 10-12-15 at checkout. That's TEN1215 at checkout. Shop today over at charliehustle.com. Charlie Hustle, vintage made fresh. My name is Gerald Goodridge. I'm your host this week, like I am every week. And I'm joined by a man who respects 6A high school quarterback, Kyle Carpenter. Kyle, how are you?
It's been interesting watching Deion Sanders' son talk about being overlooked. I'll just say that. we all know, unlike Arch Manning coming from private school in Louisiana, that public school over private debate, the 50% of the fine, I'll leave it. Shedeur Sanders said something about Texas 6A high school football quarterbacks, Quinn Ewers, Jalen Milroe, both Texas commits at one point, but both elite Texas high school prospects were 50% of the quarterbacks in the playoff last year. Anyways, it's fine. Look at me. I'm a Sanders.
There's a shocking lack of self-awareness by talking about the small private school he went to, because it's either Prime Prep, which was shown to be a sham, or it was the $30,000 a year private school he went to, other than his dad's school that turned out to be a sham. Sham. Wanted to say it three times, but we're not here to talk about, it's hard to call him a Nepo baby because he's actually talented.
He's very talented.
The advantage. But like, there's some advantages there that I feel like other people don't have.
I don't want to say I hate Shedeur Sanders. I don't want this to come off. We're starting our podcast on the wrong foot. I actually like him quite a bit because I love Deion, but I just think it's funny. Anyone could be a victim in 2024, I guess. That's all I'll say.
Speaking of victims, the Texas ladies made a pair of them in Austin this weekend, advancing to the 18th Sweet 16 in program history. The men turned out to be a victim of themselves, against Tennessee in that second round loss. You've also got a lot of down the 40. Trophies were raised. Sweeps were had. A lot to talk about. Obviously, we'll close the show out with some Godzillatron and some Bang the Drum. But we're going to talk about the ladies of Moody Gymnasium going through. And, you know, the Drexel game to start, 40 points in an NCAA game is a bit much. I don't know, Kyle. It is the gift from The Simpsons, stop it, he's already dead, comes to mind when you think about that. But 75,000 fans packed the Mood to watch the ladies move on to the second round of the NCAA tournament. And then it was close for a minute, but they pulled away late, topping Bama 65-54 in front of nearly 10,000 folks on Sunday afternoon. A big, big weekend for the ladies. A massive couple of statements to open the tournament.
Yeah, this is very good. This is the March Madness bracket that you should have been following the entire time, but certainly Texas fans will migrate their way over. Texas fans migrated their way to the Mood. I'll give credit where it's due. 10,000 showing up loud and proud. I respect it. A true home court advantage, and they played up to it. You're right, Gerald. A 40-point win was wild, getting them to that 18th Sweet 16 in program history. It was interesting because Maddie Booker missed a double-double in that game because she only got 8 points, but they weren't needed. She had 14 assists, which set a UT program record, a true point guard performance, a program record in an NCAA tournament game, I should say. But she also, my favorite part about that was she moved into second on the Longhorn freshman assist list. That is, of course, trailing Rory Harmon's 180. She has 176, so that will likely surely be broken in this next game that they play. So interesting, right? We talked about Maddie Booker being not a point guard. She's about to break the consummate point guard's freshman record. Just another data point in how incredible her season has been. Shayla Gonzalez in this one against Drexel was incredible. Hit 5 of 6 threes. That's the key, right? In Texas against Bama, we'll talk a little bit about that game. Went inside and really focused on getting big, playing big, protecting the rim to try to slow down and stop Bama's, you know, run really fast or throw it to their one good post player. Texas had a good strategy to combat that, and it was to get big against that kind of defense that they were playing, that zone. And it worked well in that game, but in this one, they let it fly from deep. Shayla Gonzalez hitting all 5 of Texas 3-pointers, but 5 of 6 is great. We're gonna need some of that in some of these games coming up. Taylor Jones did what she did in that one, 18 points, and Deanna Gaston had a double-double, 11 and 10. My favorite stat line though from Drexel was Shea Holly. I don't know if she scored a point, but she had 7 rebounds, 4 blocks, and 3 steals. Like, that may be the most Vic Schaefer, like, his most beloved box score of his entire career. It's just like someone who's a 40-minute starter in a game where you're up 40, just dominating in all the things, the little things that that matter for a Vic Schaefer team. But yeah, that all went out the window when you get to the round of 32, and it was, you know, beating a good FSU team. It was Bama, and Texas had a task ahead of them. But I thought they had a game plan. They stuck to it. They didn't play particularly well in this one. Like, they really truly left as much meat on the bone as you possibly can in a double digit, you know, tournament win. But they didn't play particularly well, at least on the offensive side of the game, and they still got a win, and that's somewhat reassuring. But there is a little bit of a, you know, a little bit of concern for they need to clean these things up to get to the goals they want to get to.
Like you said, there were, and I think you put it out there on Twitter, Texas missed so many bunnies, right? It's Easter weekend. They cannot miss that many bunnies. They managed to beat Bama 65-54 in that game in spite of all of the misses from close range, right? They still scored 34 in the paint, but probably left at least 15 or 16 on the floor. Texas did, though, clean those up and collect those 18 offensive rebounds for them. And really, there was a sequence I think that was emblematic of how Vic Schaefer wanted to play this game. Texas forced a pair of shot clock violations and then came up with the steal in back-to-back-to-back possessions. And that is very much what Vic Schaefer wants to do and how Vic Schaefer wants to win these games. And so they did it against Bama. And I think even when Bama tried to come back, Texas kind of put the vices on them and did a little bit of a squeeze and kind of went to that pressure that they like to apply. And it worked out really, really well for them. So I think for Texas to get where they need to go and want to go in the future, obviously they're going to have to clean up those easy ones. But I think there's an opportunity for them to. It is an exciting thing, not an exciting thing, but it's a positive thing to see that they, in spite of those struggles, were able to come away with a pretty, you know, double digit win.
Again, it's relative in how you struggle, right? They were great on the defensive end. They held a Bama team that was averaging 74 points a game to 54, right? They held them to 20 points under their season average in a tournament, right? That's great when they do that during the regular season. You say, oh, that's good. But then in the NCAA tournament, they're holding a team to 20 points under their average. That's showing you the Texas defensive prowess that they have. The 11 block shots tie a program record for an NCAA game. The 9 steals, Gerald mentioned, the shot clock violations. They took some charges. I mean, I think they played exactly on that side of the ball how Vic wanted them to play. Didn't give anything easy to Alabama. But yeah, just felt like since they weren't really settling for the three a bunch, Leah Moore, actually, her 4th three on the season was the only 3-pointer that they made. It was a lot of, you know, mid-range from Maddie Booker, which most of the game that was elite. Second half, really 4th quarter, she cooled off a little bit, but still had 21 points, 6 rebounds, and a pair of steals. But yeah, it felt like they really ran the plays to get the ball inside. And then, like you mentioned, they just didn't finish, didn't execute. I will give credit, though, to Aaliyah Moore, who's my player of the game, even though Booker was great. 21 points, 10 rebounds, 2 blocks. The announcer was clearly enamored with Amo, who isn't, but just kept calling her like, she's an old school hooper. And I like it. I don't think he's wrong. Like, it's like, what does she do better than anyone in the country? It's not one thing. It's the whole package of just how she goes out and takes what the defense gives her and makes plays. Like this game, shooting a 3, getting to the free throw line, making defensive plays, picking up rebounds. Like, Texas went big, and so a lot of times she was the second post and still just made her stuff happen. I think Taylor Jones could add 20 points if she got all hers near the rim. Amina Muhammad missed a bunch. I mean, it just like it really was 20 some odd points on bunnies at the rim that were left. So again, we always joke about it, but the best type of wins are good, sound, comfortable wins like this one was, where the coach still gets to light into his team and you know, do some coaching. So, you know, Vic, he was complaining about a 40-point win in Drexel, them missing a box out, like legitimately. Had them practicing after that, you know, boxing out. And so in this one, you know, there's going to be some coaching coming from him because he demands perfection because he expects that's what's needed to go where they want to go.
I'm with you. And so where they need next up next for them, where they're going, they've got Utah, the winner of Utah and Gonzaga. We're recording currently at 8:39 p.m. That game tips at 9:30, well past my bedtime, but that'll be in Portland on Friday, whoever they take on in that one. The men, after a big first round win, come away and play another ugly one and manage to, they can't quite pull off the comeback. They fell apart early, went down big early, battled back, played aggressive, really dialed things up, and then some defensive snafus, some bad calls caught up to them. They fell to Tennessee 62-58. They played with heart. They played tough. They didn't have any killers at this point, right? Yeah. There's not that guy. You know, you wonder if Tyrese Hunter was supposed to be that guy or Max Asemus was supposed to be that guy or who it might be. But when a push comes to shove, they didn't have the take over the game and get stuff done, dude. And that really was the big, we saw flashes of it from some guys. Like we saw some flashes of it from Weaver. We saw some flashes of it from Shedrick in some spots. I think Shedrick played better than Dylan Disu in a lot of this tournament. But either way, Texas bows out in the second round, falling to Rick Barnes. Rick Barnes doing what he couldn't do at Texas, moving on to the second weekend of the tournament. When we look back on the year overall, Kyle, obviously this game, but the year overall, it's so weird to feel such a like mixed set of feelings, right? Like this could have been way worse, but it could have been way better too.
Yeah, and I've been between two minds. I think ultimately it averages out, and a mix may be one way to put it, but I just kind of feel nothing. This is about
ambivalence.
Yeah, this is about what I expected. I mean, you think back a month or two ago when it was like, is Texas going to make the tournament, right? To hear they got out of the first, you know, the first game to the round of 32 and were within a bucket or two of you know, getting to the Sweet 16. It's like, wow, okay, I would have taken that. When we saw the bracket announced and it was Tennessee, I mean, I hope everyone really roots for the home team, but I certainly picked Tennessee in my bracket. Like, I expected a loss, and I didn't know how close or how bad it would be, but I mean, that's a really good Tennessee team that's loaded. They play great defense, loaded with some just, I mean, I remember when we played them the past few years and watching guys like Zakai Ziegler, who's just a, you know, I would love that guy. He does everything Doge Balbay did, but with a little bit more offense and ability to run the team. You know, I love that type of player. And so does Rick Barnes, clearly. But you know, they're a good team, but okay, Texas fell to them as we expected, but the recipe was also there for a March Madness upset of a 2 seed because, you know, how does that happen? Well, it's good defense from Texas for sure. They played better in these 2 games in the tournament, better defense than they did all season. But it also takes one of those games where the shots just don't fall. And I don't care how good of a defense Texas was playing, making a team go 3-for-25. And it was honestly like 1-for-20 until they hit two towards the end in the second half. Mm-hmm. But 3-for-25 from deep, like you just don't expect that. Tennessee didn't have a game where they made less than 5 all season. You just don't expect 12% from deep or 34% from the field. That certainly helped make it closer. Now, Texas giving up 17 turnovers and only shooting 36% themselves is what made it just a sloppy, sloppy game of no one wants to win. But yeah, I mean, it hurts a little because you're right. If they had a killer, if they had a takeover, if they had a Sir Jabari Rice, if they had a man of the moment, this certainly was a winnable game. I mean, they were down a lot, but they fought back to where, you know, it's a 1-point game with 40 seconds left, right? Tennessee played the script out where they wanted to lose this game, and Texas just didn't carpe that diem. And that, you know, that's tough, right? There's multiple things you can point to. There's multiple plays where Texas form, you know, gets a shot clock violation, forces a turnover, does something good on one end of the court, and then literally threw the ball away on inbounds passes. Like, not even inbounds plays under the hoop trying to run a play. Like, inbounding the ball. They had like five turnovers inbounding the ball. Texas's, I'll just call it flat out laziness, right? It felt like they weren't prepared, or they forgot. And I don't know if you forget when you're well into the second half that Tennessee's going to jump passing lanes. If you float passes and lob them, they probably had five, six, eight passes that could have been picked off, almost were, in addition to all the turnovers they had. It was a sloppy game, and it was not a Tyrese Hunter, you know, special. He's fluctuates wildly. This was not one of his best performances, but it's not just him, right? Ace Smith disappeared, you know, the eighth all-time collegiate scorer, you know, barely mustered double-digit points in this one. DCU, as good as he was in last year's tournament, he may have been as bad in this year's tournament just from a shooting perspective. I love the way he hustled and played defense, you know, when it wasn't going for him on the other end. But it was team-wide, the struggle in this one, right? And again, Gerald, to take two lenses, there's a season-wide view where this team really missed some athleticism, and you could see some of the transfers that were added at the end when they lost their two big-time high school recruits that were just kind of bodies and didn't necessarily fit. Like, I love IT Horton, what he could do at his best, but a lot of times you don't get his best. And so even though he's a good rebounder as a guard and can be a very good three-point shooter, his defense leaves to desire, so he can't really be out there. Weaver is best as a sixth man to give him that energy, but he had to play a lot of minutes because he didn't have another guard who could play that level of defense that Hunter does. You know, Shedrick had injury issues, and just, you know, I really like to see him healthy next year and see how that goes. DeSue obviously battled injuries all year. You know, like the composition of this team, just, I'm not judging Terry off of this year. I want to see what happens next year with some great recruits who actually make it to campus. But it just felt like in this game, out of all the games this season, and maybe there was a couple others, they missed that big athletic wing who could score the ball, right? Little Asmus not being able to get a shot up against a good defense, DeSue settling for you know, deep threes. It just felt like they needed that other guy. They were most successful when Hunter attacked the rim or Weaver attacked the rim, like another athletic. Give me that Jordan Hamilton wing who's just slashing and attacking. And I think this team could have been something a little bit different.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. This team could have been, and the roster construction, I think, is something that you hit on. And I think, you know, you don't anticipate your two big key high school kids taking other options right now. And I'm not mad that the G League option is going away. I'm not mad about that at all. So I think for Texas, right, the constructing next year's roster is going to be a big deal, right? Because players that are gone for sure, Brock Cunningham, for good or for ill, depending on how you feel about him. Dylan DeSue, IT Horton, Max Asmus. You also got the freshman or sophomore forward that entered the transfer portal this week during the tournament. So those guys are gone. Players that still have eligibility. Caden Shedrick already announced that he will be coming back. Weaver Onyema, Chris Johnson, Devin Pryor, pair of freshmen. Players that have eligibility but we're not sure about. Tyrese Hunter and Dylan Mitchell. Trey Johnson, Cam Scott, and Nicholas Cody are all probably going to have something to say about when and how and who decides to come back. But the roster construction should be a little more athletic, I think, looking into 2024-25.
And even when you look at Trey Johnson and Cam Scott, the two kind of elite prospects coming in, they're 6'5 and 6'6 as guards, right? I think Terry wants to build a little bit more with a Hunter Asmus. Like, they were limited a little bit when they ran that as their, I mean, that is their best guard pairing this year. But, you know, you're two guys who are 6 foot tall. It limits you a little bit. And Asmus wears those platform shoes to get to 6 foot. It limits a little bit of what you can do on the defensive side. It limits a little bit of what, you know, you can do just generally. So bringing in some more size, hopefully with Shedrick there and some other bigs, if Mitchell comes back and even, you know, another big to replace DeSue's production, it'll be interesting how he hits the portal. It'll be interesting, you know, is how this roster is ultimately put together, who he's recruiting hard from that list to come back. But there's not a ton. You're right. Like, it is Weaver who I Love is a guy off the bench because of his energy. Maybe he's a starter, you know, there, but I still don't necessarily want the ball in his hands as your number one primary scorer all the time, because it limits a little bit of what he can do as an explosive player. But, you know, you have Shedrick Weaver and I guess the two freshmen and Oyema, right? That's if you don't get anyone else, which they will, obviously, you know, that's there's something still to be had here. I think there's moves to be made, and I don't doubt Terry, right? This is, remember, the man who you know, recruited Kevin Durant. This is the man who was an ace recruiter on Barnes' staff. I think he was on 9 of 17 Barnes years in Texas. This is a player who was an ace on Chris Beard's staff before he took over. So I have no doubt that Terry, with, you know, a full understanding of what his players are going to do, whether coming or going, and some more time to go out there and work the portal, will do well, but it's going to be very interesting as they head into the SEC with some uncertainty. Again, getting Hunter and Mitchell back, at least you know what you know, but I still think there's some gaps in there for the way the roster will look if you don't go out and land a big fish.
21-13 on the year. Not the best year, not the worst year we've ever seen from Texas, but again, felt like there was still meat left on the bone, especially in that Tennessee game. So we'll obviously keep you up to date as the roster takes shape. Guys coming, guys going, where will they end up, and how will Rodney Terry build the squad to make a run in its first year in the SEC? But that brings us to the part of the show where we whip around the rest of campus and we down the 40, and we start with some championship action. Number 2 women's swimming and diving finished number 2 in the nation. 441 points is the highest total for Texas in more than 30 years. But UVA captured their 4th straight with more than 500 points, which is absolutely ridiculous. 32 All-Americans, 14 All-American honorable mentions for the Horns.
Yeah, this is their third consecutive silver medal runner-up, basically, as UVA has been on a tear, 4th in the top 3. I mean, they're right there. It's great for Director's Cup that their top 3, you know, is almost a lock for them. But you know, it's going to be a mountain to climb in the future, getting past that UVA program on both men's and women's, especially on the women's side, which is just you know, at the peak right now. There were some incredible individual performances. Emma Stickland won her 2nd consecutive 200 butterfly national title with a pool record and a come-from-behind performance. The come-from-behind, of course, was over Kelly Pash, her teammate, who finished 2nd. But nonetheless, it made her the first Texas swimmer — there was a diver to do this — but swimmer to defend her title since the legend Leanne Fetter defended 3 titles in 3 straight years, from 89 to 91. She just absolutely owned the races she competed in, and good for Stickland getting in that, you know, elite company. But Stickland also set the program record in the 100 fly, which she got a silver for, and in that one, Longhorns had 2nd through 4th place finishes, which was a good point total. And then Texas also set records in a couple of relays: the 200 free, they got bronze, and the 400 medley, in which they got silver. So all in all, a really great performance. They were 3rd after the first day, maybe even 2nd day, and then kind of, you know, got into their meat of their core events that they have dominated all year. And the points kind of fell out about where experts thought they would, with Florida a distant 3rd, and UVA honestly a distant 1st. So they fell about where they were expected to, which, you know, is good. You only could compete with who you have in the pool. Yeah, swimming is like that, right? You know, a lot, there's upsets and everything, sure, but you pretty much know, you know, about where you're going to be heading into it. You know, you have all year to find that out. So a really great season altogether, and a, you know, a solid finish. It's just, how does Carol Capitani get over a cavalier sized obstacle between her and the gold?
Nothing I can come up with, I can say on a podcast. So, again, Texas has an opportunity to continue to build. Worked some Director's Cup points, kept Stanford ahead of them, but closing ground. It's going to be a photo finish there. Number 3 softball sweeps UCF in Orlando, 5-0 on Friday, 4-2 on Saturday, 3-1 on Sunday. Mia Scott continues to climb up the list of triples, mm-hmm. 4th all time, which is absolutely ridiculous. Pitching was the pitching, it's just absolutely incredible. Texas continues to find different ways to win and different ways to look dominant through all of them.
Yeah. Friday with the shutout, it's Tegan Kevin going and getting her third seven-inning shutout. The freshman looking amazing. I think her 11th or 12th win on the year. And then you have the Sunday game. That was a 5-0 win. The Sunday game, a 3-1 win, where Mac Morgan only allows two hits in her four innings, and then Tegan comes in again and retires seven straight to get her second save in that one. And then, you know, in a really close Saturday game, it was and I think all throughout the weekend, defense deserves to be praised against UCF as well as Florida State, who we talked about in our last podcast, who they run ruled, obviously, a really good Florida State team. But defense was great and let the pitchers kind of do. But on Saturday's game specifically, some credit goes to the speed on this team, which I've talked about a few times, and then the coaching from Mike White, right? It was, I think in the fifth inning, it was a 0-0 game. They really didn't have a lot of base runners, neither did UCF. It was a pitching battle. And then they decide to go with a pinch runner and then kind of a hit and run in the fifth to get their first run across. And then in the sixth, Mia Scott, White sends her because she's fast as lightning. And gets initially called out at the plate in that sixth inning, but White reviews it. She made a great play to avoid the tag, and they get the 3-2 lead, which eventually they added one more too. But, you know, it was the difference in the game. And again, giving up three runs on a weekend, or three runs in four games, because they took care of Florida State as well. And what they did against BYU, they've been holding some great offenses pretty well. 25.1 inning scoreless streak was snapped in that Saturday game when they gave up the first run to UCF, but they longest of the season. They've been really, really good pitching and really, really good defensively, and their base running and hitting has been, I will say, just really good. But with some players being exceptional. Reese Atwood got another home run in this one. There's just a lot to like about this softball team, but boy, do they have a test the next couple weeks.
The Oklahoma two-step. Stillwater starts this weekend, number 4 Oklahoma State on Thursday through Saturday. But Kyle, we've got our Podstradamus prize picks moment for you. Remember, prize picks is the best legal way to play player props in state like California, Florida, Texas, and more. Easy way to play daily fantasy. Pick 2 to 5 players, go over and under. It's just you versus the projected numbers, and you can win up to 10 times on any entry. And on top of all that, you can get a 100% instant deposit match of up to $100 by using the code Longhorn12 when you sign up. So Kyle, what is our prize picks trivia ? Of the day?
Gerald, I'm going to set the line for you here with an over under. I'll give you a little bit of a hint. Texas has been a third inning machine. They, in the Sunday game against UCF, the most recent game they played, were 2-0 advantage in the third inning. And that is not a new thing for Texas. Texas run differential through 31 games. Gerald, I'm going to set the over under at 60.5.
Oh, I'm going over. I'm going over for sure.
Okay. I thought I could entice you with a slightly lower number. No, you crushed it. It is 73. It is 73 runs. They are 79 to 73. It's 76 runs that they are up. So you nailed it with the under. They are dominating. Plus 70 anything is unreal, but third inning is the inning to watch if you're a Longhorn fan. Found that stat and found it amazing. So thanks, Gerald, for picking, and thanks to Prize Picks for sponsoring this podcast.
Let's keep it on the diamond. Baseball gets a series win over Baylor. They fell on Friday 4-3 in extras. Then the ace took the mound on Saturday. Texas got a bounce back win 10-2. And then a run rule series clinch in 11-1 on Sunday. Again, the pitching was incredible. The bats obviously getting you there on Sunday. So much to choose from. But Kyle, I think the story of the weekend is Ace Whitehead and his complete game first ever Saturday start.
Yeah, I mean, it's ace, and it's simply that Texas seems to have found their rotation. It took a while. They are, you know, well into the season, but this feels like maybe they've settled into a rotation for their weekend starters. And you know, at the top with LeBaron Johnson, you know where that was going to be. You know, a lot of obviously Tanner Witt injury looming over this, but as they tried really the past 2 years to figure out how to replace his production, it seems like maybe they have finally figured it out. And they, though they lost a close one on Friday, they got punched in the mouth and responded. And again, I think you're right that they needed every one of those innings from Whitehead, from Ace Boogie. 9 innings, 2 earned runs, 6 hits, 5 strikeouts, only gave up 1 walk. Just threw strikes. He never topped 87 on the radar, but threw strikes, battled, and over the final 6 innings, only allowed 1 base runner. Seemed to get better as he went. I think Ace, you know, a legendary small-town high school quarterback as well, is just a competitor, just a gamer, just a guy who wants to go out and fight on the mound. And, you know, a two-way player for Texas who's played outfield before he solidified in the bullpen. He can do a lot of things, but again, the thing that you love most about him is his mentality that he brings to the mound.
Yeah, the dude just, like, he came and he pushed and he was absolutely incredible. Like, there's no two ways around it. You know, he was a battler, right? Struck out 5, like, not going to blow you away, but again, threw strikes, stayed in there. Just absolutely incredible performance. Again, the bat showed up for him as well, Jared Thomas.
Sure.
2 home runs, 4 RBIs. Gasparino hit a 3-run home run from the 6th spot. Like, mm-hmm. Texas is really starting to put it together, and if this team can hit the level that we can see from them, and the level that, like, again, this is a team that could probably do a lot of damage in the postseason if they play like they did this weekend against Baylor, right? And Baylor's not the elite team that they're going to be playing, but again, the hitting is there, right? And the pitching seems to be getting it together. I'm still curious about the relievers. I still think we have questions there, but again, if you get, you know, you don't need to get a complete game from your pitcher every time, but if you can get 7 good innings from a guy, mm-hmm. I think there's an opportunity to salve over or wallpaper over some of those issues.
Yeah, and you're right. And even the Friday game that they lost, right, was a close one. They did get 7 good innings. LeBaron Johnson, 7 innings, gave up 3 on 9 hits, had 4 strikeouts. And then Gage Bohm came in and actually pitched relatively well, only gave up 2 hits in 4 innings of relief. He took the loss since the bats couldn't quite respond. But Texas, you know, gave up 2 runs in the 7th. They're trailing 3-2 in the 8th, loaded the bases with nobody out, only able to tie it up 3-3. If they're able to do that, get that extra run right there, you know, it doesn't go to extras, and they probably sweep the series, and you're feeling even better about it. But the Sunday game after those two openers was the most interesting to me, because you got to always win on Sundays, win the series, close it out. If you've won 2, get the sweep. Like, win on Sundays, it sets the tone for how you feel going into the week. But the Sunday 11-1 run ruling, I think, was a bit cathartic. It's what they needed. They played 8 innings. And this one really came down to Texas having the max. They had the maximum max. That would be, of course, Max Ballou and Max Grubbs. Max Grubbs, the starting pitcher, went 7 innings, only gave up 1 earned, 5 hits, 5 Ks. Again, like Gerald said, give me 7 good innings. And he certainly did. And then Max Ballou really, like, is writing his own Texas legend here. He's putting up Melendez numbers, basically. I think I saw a stat that the last hitter to do what he's done through his first whatever at bats, because he didn't get many his freshman year, but as a sophomore here, he's basically, I'm not saying going to exactly match Melendez's all-time records, but is certainly, he has that power. He's quick and just, man, that ball is heavy and hard off the bat. He swings powerfully. And this is what we predicted in our season preview, and it's finally coming to fruition as he's moved up into that 5th spot, and they've kind of rejiggered the lineup a little bit. It feels like with Gasparino hitting his stride and Max, you know, having 6 RBIs, being named the Big 12 Player of the Week, Texas had 4 home runs on the day, and 3 of them are Max, tying the Texas record with 3 in a game, one of 8 players to ever do that.
For his trouble, we talked about Max Ballou, which is even better, took home Big 12 Player of the Week with that tie, hit a home run in the 1st, 4th, and 8th innings, leads the Big 12 with 11 home runs, hit a clean 500 on the week, which hitting 300 on the week is pretty good. So 500 is real good for them. On the season, Texas is hitting 304, 61 doubles, 46 dingers, while the pitching staff has a 3.98 ERA, 194 strikeouts. So absolutely an opportunity for the pitching staff to kind of get itself going and get itself back where it needs to go. And up next, they have a season-long, they're closing out that long home stand against Texas A&M Corpus Christi on Tuesday, the day you're listening to this, before a weekend series against Kansas State. On the hard surface, big upset in the tennis world. Number 8 men's tennis not only beat, but swept number 2 TCU 5-0. Fifth straight win, third consecutive sweep, all against ranked opponents. That 8 is going to continue to shrink. Texas is going to continue to rise up the rankings and hopefully make some waves in the postseason.
Yeah, they swept UCF earlier in the weekend before sweeping TCU, which was just a huge, huge statement. They avenged a 4-3 loss in Fort Worth to the Horned Frogs earlier this month. And there's been some change in multiple ways since that loss at the beginning of the month. I think there's been the you know, tangible change, right? They switched up their doubles lineups, and it's paid off. They won the doubles points pretty consistently since then, including in this one. There's also been a mindset change, and Coach talks about it a little bit, Coach Burke, just to say that they never doubted themselves. He never saw this team think that they weren't one of the top 2 or 3 teams in the country, but there was a lot of frustration. And sometimes it's just getting the win, winning 4-3 instead of losing 4-3, right? Having those goes down to the last single, and you don't get it. Those can hurt, those can frustrate, and those can break a team. But I don't know if it's the literal brotherhood with the pair of brothers on this team, or just the fact that all these, this experience and these players who came back and came to Texas for this, it's finally that belief is setting in, and seeing it in a very dominant fashion. This was a huge, huge win. I mentioned they won the doubles. They also won singles over number 6, 8, 57, and 72. They clinched with Michael Braswell plus both YBs, Pierre and Eves. Leaving 5 and 6 unfinished, but I like this. They let number 1 play out, and it was a doozy. It was Spazieri over Pennington, a top 10 matchup, in a sensational third set tiebreaker. It was 4-6, 7-5, and then 1-0 in a 12-point breaker. It was a titan clash of two guys who've been ranked number 1, two guys who have been number 1 singles for teams that were competing for national championships. Just a great matchup of two of the better players in college tennis. And of course, we love it when it goes Texas's way. That's why it's a 5-0 sweep and not a 4-0 sweep.
It's impressive what they've done with this midseason change. And again, I think they'll continue to build some momentum. Next up for them, heading to Provo on Thursday to start 4 straight road matches. They've got BYU to kick that off. Number 7, women go 1-1 on the week, fall 4-3 to number 1 Oklahoma State in the third set of the final singles match. Just a heartbreaker. Then they swept Kansas State to continue there, outside of Oklahoma State being playing really, really well. 5 of 13 wins have been against top 15 opponents this year. Losses have been twice to number 1 and once to number 2, which is absolutely incredible and shows how elite this team is.
Said it in the beginning, like, I was curious how high this team rises just because they're really balanced and really strong against the, you know, Oklahoma State. It feels like they're like one little bit behind where, again, number 1 Oklahoma State is, indoor national champion Oklahoma State. They're a really, really good team, but it's their losses. Texas is so stinking close. 2 losses this close, it makes me feel a little bit confident that the trend has to break, and maybe it'll flip the other way when we get to the outdoor, the big one, the national championship coming up in a few weeks here. You know, they'll look to get a little bit of revenge. Hopefully this will only make them hungrier for it. But yeah, I hate the heartbreak of losing to that Oklahoma State team, especially after they won doubles, including over the number 8 doubles team, and singles wins, 2 top 100 singles wins. It's just, that's a really top to bottom, super incredibly talented cowgirls, is that what they say, Oklahoma State team. Regardless, they took it out on Kansas State by sweeping the heck out of them. Their 5th sweep in 7 Big 12 matches, again, one of those being the Oklahoma State match. So they've really, there's 2 people at the top of the Big 12, and they just happen to be 2 of the top in the country, Oklahoma State and Texas.
Rounding out the country club section of our day, number 18 men's golf kicked off two rounds at the Valspar Collegiate in Palm City. Almost said Panama City. Palm City, Florida, with 10 top 25 and 5 top 10 matchups. Texas, 14th on Monday. Hope to climb up the leaderboard on Tuesday.
All right, Joe, let's keep it rolling. We're going to skip some burnt orange lenses. We'll give some more spring football updates as we get closer to that spring game, but we'll skip and go straight to Godzillatron. Joe, what are you watching on your giant screen?
A lot of basketball this weekend. Not sure. A ton of leisure watching. I did, however, watch X-Men 97 on Disney Plus, which is the continuation of the 90s X-Men animated series. Continues to be incredible. A lot of online conversation about that. My son also had his first baseball game this weekend, so nice. Spent a lot of time dealing with that. So not a ton. Continuing my audiobook series that I've been talking about for several weeks now. So that's been my world the last couple of days.
Love it. Gerald, have you seen The Holdovers?
I have not.
Okay. I heard a lot about this film. A Christmas movie in the sense that it certainly takes place. Christmas is the driving factor of the story and narrative, but it's not your traditional feel-good Christmas movie for sure. But it's a great movie. It's a great film. I'd heard very good things. I think it got a few, you know, Oscar nominations and a few wins. I love Paul Giamatti. I think I've told on this podcast before that.
Who doesn't?
Distantly related to Paul through marriage. Paul Giamatti, his brother, married my like second cousin. Anyways, Uncle Paul, as I call him. He was great. He plays a very Paul Giamatti character, like this curmudgeonly professor or teacher at a boarding school. Basically, the story is set at a boarding school in you know, Andover style in the Northeast in the 70s, maybe 1970 about. And it's the holdovers are the kids who don't get to go home in the 2-week Christmas break. And there starts with a bigger group, and I won't give anything away, but it's whittled down to just one student. And so basically the lunch lady, the professor who is assigned, and this one student have some epic adventures, including some road trips to out of campus and into Boston. Some hijinks ensued, but it's a sad boy Christmas story. Like there's a lot of it's not. I mean, there's laughs. It's funny. It's charming in ways, but it's also there's a lot of feelings and emotions, and I okay. like that. Like it's different, but it deals with, you know, some of like depression and what how you adapt with your life not going exactly the way you thought it would, and how sometimes seemingly, you know, the kid who's got it all really has some incredibly dark and trying and troubling things underneath the surface, and there's like they kind of bond over taking the same depression medicine, right? Like it's like there's this interesting like how you wear down people who are unlikable and curmudgeonly and hermits to themselves to get a little bit of humanity, and like there's a beauty in that, but it's also like it's not cloyingly, sappily sweet. It never, you know, it's bittersweet in the truest form. It never goes over the top. But some great performances. Divine Joy Randolph, I think, won some awards for her role as Mary in there. The guy who plays the main student, Angus, is a like breakout. I think he is like a boarding school kid who it's his first acting role. So it's cool to see kind of the raw acting there. But I thought it's really good. And the thing that's most impressive about it is they do an incredible job with the aesthetics of 1970. The look, the Northeast, or you know, the kind of New England area doesn't have a lot of progress anyway, so there's a lot of buildings and things that they could very easily kind of make look 1970 is 50 years ago. That's crazy. 50 years old, like the cars, the clothing, but the way they shot it as well on the film, like it just looks, I don't know, it's fun if you have any interest in cinematography. It just looks great. It looks like a film that could have been plucked literally out of the 70s. It's not hokey in the way that they do it, and I just felt like the everything about it was like great time in place. It's not the story that's going to change your life, but I thought it's a very good story and a very good film ultimately. I don't know how many times I'm going to rewatch it. I don't think it'll be like a Christmas tradition, but I really enjoyed it.
I've heard good things and it's been on my list of things to watch. It just hasn't happened. It's something that I need to do and want to do. But that list keeps growing as you have children, Kyle. Be prepared. But that brings us to the part of the show where we honor one of the best traditions in all of college athletics, Big Bertha, and we bang the drum, brought to you by Joe Ruiz. So, Kyle, what are you banging the drum on this week?
Gerald, I don't think it's ever been hidden on this very podcast that we are not the biggest fans of Kim Mulkey.
Boo.
When Kim Mulkey was at Baylor, you could see two Texas fans like Gerald and I, who you know, get encouraged and I guess paid to cover the Texas Longhorns, thinking Mulkey's the worst because she was very good at winning basketball games. Like, and that would be fair. You often hate an opposing team's coach if they build a dynasty and win games. But when Mulkey left to go to the SEC, it was like, good, we don't have to see her again. A, because it's tough teams, and B, she's just so unlikable. But it felt like something about her homecoming of going back to Louisiana, leaving Baylor, you know, changing it up. It also really exposed getting out of the Waco market to LSU. It exposed to a wider audience who Kim Mulkey is and the reason that Gerald and I don't particularly like her and the reason that most of her peers don't particularly like her and the reason that many of her former players don't particularly like her. And that in itself could be said on any week's podcast. So why are we talking about it this week? Well, if you somehow missed it, Kim Mulkey went on a libel campaign. Like, she claims slander for something that hasn't been written. Effectively, the Washington Post, there's a story that's been teased that may be explosive about Kim Mulkey. And so she had a press conference during a March Madness tournament run to refute every piece of a story that has yet to be published, which did a few things, right? Many people who had no interest in the story are now eagerly awaiting when the Washington Post story drops. It proves for sure that whatever is said in it is true and she's absolutely guilty, and it will be, it'll paint her in a very bad light, and it will be true. She's not a great person. She's not considerate. She has multiple accusations and absolutely true stories of at least, let's generously say, racially insensitive incidents. She has been not particularly compassionate to her players and their identities. Just an unlikable, curmudgeonly, awful woman who called it a hit piece, talked about how this reporter only gave her a week to respond to the story after he hounded her, and this is her words, hounded her for 2 years to answer the questions. Like, she just refuted every one of her claims. You know, again, calling something that hasn't been written a hit piece is just so telling of a certain mindset. But I still think the quote of it was that she basically just said they're trying to sell newspapers and feed their click machine, which is a great, great summation of journalism in 2024. And I think every journalist should make it part of their tagline. But I mean, at the end of the day, it comes down to Kim Mulkey is not just an unlikable person, but not a good person. And you see that when the way she handled this, the way she's done it. And I'm actually excited for this to come to light. I hope what this ultimately ends up in is the sport of women's basketball not having to have Kim Mulkey. Look, it's good to have a villain. Like, everyone in the country hates her. I love Angel Reese. I love many of the players on her team, but I hate her and I hate LSU because of her. I guess that's good. You have to have a villain as the sport is rapidly exploding and growing. But it will be better to just have a villain because a team is good or plays tough and not be a terrible person off the court. Like, the sport of women's basketball, for all the success she's brought to it, will be better when Kim Mulkey is out of it and removed.
My dad, the font of wisdom that he once was, one of the things that he always said to me is that nobody that's done nothing wrong preemptively defends themselves, right? Look at Jesus in front of Pilate. Jesus knew he did nothing wrong and did not present a defense against him. Now, I'm just saying. Kim Mulkey, the lady doth protest too much. I'm making the drum this week on Texas fans showing love for the ladies. If you missed it, we talked about the numbers. Over the two games, there were nearly 17,000 fans out there for Texas over those 2 days this weekend. I tried to, almost took my son up there actually for it, but that 5 o'clock tip would have been a little late if they had gotten the earlier game we could have done, but that's neither here nor there. But Michael Huff bought a bunch of student tickets, first come, first served, to get students out there, right? Kevin Durant, Rodney Terry, Jared Elliott, all there to support the ladies. This is what Texas is all about. And we've been saying it for years. It's why Kyle and I structure our show. Like, there is a reason these ladies do just as much for the university. And honestly, the ladies team spent years carrying the athletic department for years when the football team couldn't get it right, when the basketball team couldn't get it right. Still couldn't get it right. But that's neither here nor there. Support the ladies. There's a reason why these ladies give out their blood, sweat, and tears every week. They're doing incredible things. They've got an opportunity to probably compete for a national championship. So support them. Get out there. And I love, love, love to see as much support as we saw this weekend. But that's all we've got for you this week. Kyle, where can the good folks find you on the internet?
Jared, I'll just say one thing. Kevin Durant drove up from San Antonio between two Suns games that happened to be in San Antonio. Like, he wasn't just in Austin. He's in season. Like, it's so cool. Sorry, just to say, I don't want to keep adding on here, but it's so cool to see, you know, Russell Westbrook at the UCLA women's game, Kevin Durant at the UT.
Not supposed to say those names together anymore.
I guess that's true. But it's just amazing to see that. It matters. People are watching. People are tuning in. Like, my last week bang the drum was about Plies saying, get the men off my TV. I want to see the women's bracket. Like, people are tuning in. There are stars. There are reasons to watch. There are, you know, crazy games that have happened. That Iowa State Stanford game was wild. Like, you know, UT is going to have a tremendous matchup on their hands coming up in the future. So there's a ton to watch. I'll just leave it at that. I won't belabor it. If you want to find me on social media, Gerald, you can follow me on Twitter at Kyle Carpenter. You can also follow the Texas Pregamer at Texas Pregamer.
Follow me on Twitter at GH Goodrich. Follow the show on Twitter at Longhorn Pod. Facebook, Instagram, Longhorn Republic. Shoot us an email, longhornrepublicpod@gmail.com. We'll be back next week. And until then, hook 'em.
Hook 'em. Texas is women's sports school.